I would like that very much.
The Lord works in mysterious ways. You, Six, are the most mysterious way I have ever encountered.
Court found himself wanting to believe God was working through him and not Satan himself. But he did not know. He did not understand. But he did not lament the killing he had done, the measures he had taken here. He did not lament for 1 second, one drop of the blood he had shed to save the woman in front of him. She was beautiful. She was good. She was perfect. And she was alive.
Go with God, my friend,
she said, and she hugged him, looked into his eyes, stood, then disappeared back through the sacristy and into the sanctuary. And she was gone. Court sat for a few minutes alone, then stood and returned to the sanctuary himself for a moment more. The room felt big and empty, but welcoming somehow. He'd spent time in churches around the world, but only for operational reasons, and his mind never drifted beyond the details of his work. Now he looked around, perhaps for the first time in his life, and he wondered about this place. Was there a point to all this? His eyes turned to the crucifix. He stared at it a long time before whispering, "Thanks." His mobile phone rang. It was the number he'd given Hector Cerna. He walked out of the side entrance of the sanctuary into a cool, sunny afternoon. "Yeah?" It was not Cerna. It was Madrigal. He spoke in his mountain Spanish, and Court struggled to understand.
"You left Calvo alive?"
"Yes."
"Why?"
"I think you need some competition." A long pause.
"I should have killed you when you gave me that gun."
"Yes," Court admitted. "You should have."
"I will kill you."
"Take a number, cowboy."
"You are a worthless piece of shit, motherfucking son of a whore."
"I'm an outlaw." Another long pause.
"If men ever get to live on other planets, you should be the first man off of this one. Everyone wants you dead."
"Yep."
"Someone soon will get you. You must know that."
"I know that. I find comfort in the fact that so many people will be sad it wasn't them." Court hung up the phone and then tossed it into a municipal garbage can a few blocks away. Epilogue. San Blas felt different to Gentry now. He arrived at 8 in the morning, found the weather cooler, and an ocean wind off the Pacific swirling garbage in the streets as the locals went on their way to work or school. By now, Court looked positively Latin. He stepped off the bus in his denim jacket and blue jeans, a single cheap backpack over his shoulder, his dark skin and sunglasses and trim hair, beard, and goatee blended nicely with the other men his age. He wore earbud headphones in his ears, plugged into his phone, but he was not listening to music. No, the headphones were just a part of the costume. The only rhythms the gray man listened to were the footsteps behind him and the soft conversations of those around him. He was on guard here in San Blas, more so now than 2 weeks earlier on his first visit to the fishing village. He knew they were after him, and he knew they were close. He'd given up concentrating on who they were. It didn't really matter anymore. He walked the road to the hill, past the lobster shacks and the little churches and truckloads of armed Marines on patrol, and he took another steep road up a steep hill. He'd taken this same road the last time he was in town, heading up to look for Eddie's grave, and then heading down with Eddie's pregnant wife. So much had changed in that time. But to Court, everything felt like it had before. He'd acquired cuts and bruises and scrapes and burns, but his quest now was the same as then. Mexico was just a bump in the road for him. He walked up towards the entrance to the cemetery, saw the cheap mausoleums of tin and plastic sheeting and cement block off to his left. An iguana raced by on the road ahead of him. Chickens clucked in the last house up the hill before the beginning of the cemetery and the entrance to an old church and accounting office that dated back to the middle of the 19th century. But he passed the cemetery, kept walking up. It was a normal security sweep for him, more automatic than brought on by any sense of danger or threat. It was second nature to make wide, lazy turns, to stop and retrace steps, to wait in the shadows for someone following, to move through the landscape like a wraith. He finally turned left well past the cemetery, much higher on the hill, and he entered a grove of low grass surrounded by wild-growing banana trees 2 stories high. He moved deeper into the woods, turned towards the cemetery. He'd come all this way, a 3-hour bus ride, just to see Eddie's resting place one more time. Court thought about leaving something there, under the dirt, as a remembrance for his friend. But he did not have much with him. Court was not a sentimental man. Perhaps his mindset was as close to the opposite end of the spectrum as one could come from sentimentality without being diagnosed as a sociopath. But he felt he had to come here, had to take the time and to spend the money and to make the effort to return to the place where this all started for him. He pushed through some brush. Coming back was the right thing to do, though he could not articulate why. He climbed over a whitewashed rock that had once been part of a Spanish fortress. He would not forget Eddie or Laura or Elena or Daniel de la Rocha, but he needed to put this behind him to move on. He climbed off the rock and fought through some tight vines, came out just above the cemetery. It began just a few yards down the steep hill. He'd have to leave his thoughts of Laura, his fantasy of love, and his visions of lust behind him so that he could continue on in his fight against Gregor Sidorenko. Court stopped dead in his tracks, lowered slowly to the grass. Fuck, he did not say it aloud. When he was certain he was concealed, he crawled backwards on his elbows and his knees, back into the brush and vine and banana, and then he shifted 10 yards to his right, still on his belly. It took him nearly 10 minutes to do so, but then he sat behind a carved white stone, pulled a tiny set of binoculars from his pack, checked the angle of the sun, and then rolled around the white stone and raised the glasses to his eyes. Where are you? He'd sensed movement below him, on the row of crypts south of where Eddie's cross lay. There were iguanas everywhere, but this movement was not natural to the surroundings. It was accompanied by a flash of light, the reflection of glass in the morning sun. That was all he'd been able to discern before his interior warning system had alighted and he had dropped to cover. Now he scanned with his glasses in the area of the movement, looking for whatever had aroused his alarm just a few minutes ago. There. Shit. A figure. A man prone 80 yards from Eddie's grave. He wore a fully camouflaged suit, and he looked like the brush around him and in front of him, from under a blanket of twigs and leaves indigenous to the area. A rifle's barrel and the front of a sniper scope protruded. Behind this man, not far away, was his partner. He was better concealed. He had no barrel to expose or scope that could catch the sunlight, but Court saw him when he turned his head. Shit. Court scanned the hillside cemetery now. There would not just be 2 of them. No organization in the world would send just 2 men on a mission to kill the gray man. Court could not find the others, but he knew they were there. Perhaps here with him in the brush above the cemetery. It would be a wise place to hide a follow-on force. For just a moment he wondered who they were. Sidorenko's men? SAD hunter killers? Delta Force? Vaqueros? Black suits? Did it even matter? He decided it did not. He turned his optics to Eddie's simple cross. Court could only see the backside of it down on the hill. He had no idea if more curses had been painted on it. In his pack, he'd brought white paint and a brush. He'd planned on doing the work that Elena had been doing when he met her, to restore Eddie's reputation once more before he left this place forever. But the fuckers below had ruined everything for Court. 50 yards away from him sat Eddie's lonely cross, and no one in this town would protect it. No one in this town would visit it. Sooner, not later, Court knew. No one in this town would remember Eduardo Gamboa as anything more than another cartelero, another narco-assassin, another nameless, faceless killer of men. And Court could not do anything about it at all. He could not even say goodbye. He lay there in the brush for an hour, watching the sniper, a man as still and as patient as Court himself, and then he backed up through the brush, into the wild banana, out to the road. He went back down the hill, then back past the lobster shacks, and then he caught a bus out of town.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Ballistic. Written by Mark Greeney. Narrated by Jay Snyder. Executive Producer, Steve Feldberg. Producer, Mike Charzik. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2011 by Mark Strode Greeney. Production copyright 2011 by Audible Inc.
And now a free preview of Deadeye, Book 4 in the Gray Man series.
Prologue. Leland Babbitt shot through the doors of the Hay Adams Hotel and ran down the steps to the street like he had some place to be. The White House was just across Lafayette Square, awash in lights and radiant in the cold, rainy evening. But Babbitt ignored the view, looked to his right, and began racing toward the limo waiting for him there. The chauffeur hadn't been expecting his passenger for another hour and a half, but he was a pro. He quickly extracted himself from the warm town car and opened the back door. He noticed that the man seemed to have forgotten his overcoat in his haste, to say nothing of his wife. The thickly built passenger folded quickly into the limo. The driver climbed back behind the wheel and looked into the rearview mirror for instructions. In a voice commanding yet hurried, Babbitt said,
1626 Crescent Place. Break every law you need to break, but get me there now.
The chauffeur didn't know his passenger. He'd only been hired for the night to ferry Mr. Babbitt and his wife from their home in Chevy Chase to a black tie gala here at the Hay Adams, and then back home again. But the driver knew this town. He'd been shuffling VIPs around D.C. for a quarter century. This wasn't the first time some suit had told him to blow through the lights to get to a destination on the double. He started the engine.
You got a badge?
He asked, still making eye contact with the man in the back seat via the rearview mirror.
Play like I said yes.
The chauffeur's eyebrows rose now. He'd danced this dance before.
National security?
He asked.
You bet your ass.
With a shrug, the driver said,
That'll work.
And he shoved the transmission into gear and squealed the tires. Behind him, his passenger lifted his cell phone to his ear.
En route.
The chauffeur couldn't imagine what was so important on Crescent Place, a two-lane road of majestic Georgians and neo-colonials, and he was certain he would never know. This was D.C., after all. Shit went down behind the gates of Tony residences all over the city that was far above the driver's pay grade. His job began at the front door of one building, and it ended at the front door of another, and whatever went on inside was not his problem. Babbitt had his phone clutched to his ear now, and even at speed, the driver could hear the man's voice clearly over the engine of the whisper-quiet Lincoln, short, soft blasts of interrogatives and shorter bleats that sounded like commands. The man behind the wheel did his best to tune the words out, standard operating procedure for a limo driver in Washington. 25 years hauling dips, poles, spooks, K-Street douchebags, and foreign dignitaries around the nation's capital had taught the driver discretion. To ignore his passenger's voice unless he himself was being addressed. He could have listened in. Surely the fate of nations had been decided in the backseat of his limo more than once in his career. But the driver, quite frankly, didn't give a damn. And tonight, even if he had tried to pick up on any of his passenger's side conversation, he would have heard only generic phrases, cryptic speak, and alphanumeric references. The man in back had himself spent a lot of time in limos, and he had his own standard operating procedure when being chauffeured around. If he did not know good and well that the guy behind the wheel had top-secret, sensitive compartmented information clearance with a full-scope polygraph and codeword access to the relevant program, then it was cryptic speak or nothing at all. Leland Babbitt had been in this game too damn long to rely on the professional discretion of a fucking limo driver. 1. The Lincoln squealed through a hard left turn, drifting in the slick intersection awash in the glow of headlights from angry oncoming traffic. It raced up Crescent Place and then past a small, unlit sign that read Townsend Government Services. After squeezing through electronically operated iron gates still in the process of opening, it rolled up a winding driveway lined with bare cherry trees to a huge, peach-hued brick mansion bathed in floodlights. Lee Babbitt climbed out of the Lincoln without a word to the driver and ran through the cold rain up the stone steps of the residence, passing through a door held open by a lean man in a sport coat. In the round marble foyer of the building, two more young men with military haircuts and civilian clothing stood with Heckler & Koch automatic weapons hanging from slings over their shoulders. Before anyone spoke, a man in his late 30s, some decade younger than Babbitt, came rushing up a long hallway that led to the rear of the building. He wore a cardigan sweater and corduroy slacks, and an assortment of card keys and laminated badges bounced on his chest from a chain around his neck. Babbitt met the younger man in the middle foyer, and his voice echoed off marble. "It's happening?"
"It's happening,"
the man in the cardigan confirmed.
"The assault is underway, infiltrating to target as we speak."
One man is going to hit that fucking fortress?"
"Yes, sir."
"And it's him? It's our boy?" Jeff Parks took his boss by the arm and quickly ushered him back up the hall.
"We think so."
"You'll have to do better than that," Babbitt said. While he walked, he unfastened his bow tie and opened the top button on his shirt, freeing his thick neck. "There is more than one motherfucker out there who wants to stick a knife into the neck of Gregor Sidorenko." The long hallway was trimmed with stained cherry, and the tastefully lit walls were adorned with fine art of the American West. There were Russell watercolors of cowboys on a cattle drive, regal George Catlin portraits of Native Americans, and a pair of Frederick Remington desertscapes worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, as well as a Remington bronzed buffalo statue on a side table lit by antler lamps. As they rushed up the corridor, Babbitt pulled off his damp jacket and slung it over his arm. He asked,
"How did we pick him up?"
"One of the UAVs was up on a calibration flight. No one expected activity tonight. It's Saturday. A party was in full swing at the target location until about an hour ago, which put three times the number of personnel on scene as normal. Plus, the weather's shit, and the next illumination cycle isn't for 2 days."
"Right."
"The Scan Eagle pilot spotted movement a half mile off the coast. We tracked the signature for less than a minute before determining we were most likely looking at a singleton attack on Sid's property."
"Speedboat?"
"Negative."
"Scuba?"
"That water must be less than 40 to—"
"He's not swimming."
"Then how?" Parks stopped at a door and looked up to his boss with a grin.
"You need to see this shit for yourself."
Parks scanned a card from his chain through a reader next to a heavy oaken door, then opened the door to reveal a staircase. He followed his boss down, the older man's patent leather shoes echoing in the stairwell. At the base of the stairs was another corridor. This one went back in the opposite direction, and it was, in contrast to the hallway above, narrow, dimly lit, and utilitarian, though its walls were also adorned. As the two men hurried up the hall, they passed several lighted shadow boxes of differing size. Inside the first ones were tint types and wet plate prints of severe, bearded men in black coats and top hats, hefting shotguns and standing alongside caskets propped up. Dead men inside pine boxes, looking back at the photographer, with eyes covered with coins. With these photos were mounted artifacts of the Old West, faded telegrams, single-action revolvers, stirrups and handcuffs, even a man's dress shirt, torn and stained with old black blood. Babbitt and Parks ignored the shadow boxes as they walked. They'd passed them countless times.
"So we have no assets in place?" Babbitt asked.
"I established comms with Trestle Actual. Told him he had 20 mics to assemble his boys and kit up. They are 30 miles away in St. Pete on R&R, but no worries. The UAV will track the target through the exfil.
We found him."
A satisfied smile.
"We'll get him."
A display containing a costume beard and wads of Deutschmarks taken from a captured Serbian war criminal was on their left now, and on their right, a photograph of two men with wide smiles and thumbs up, their eyes obscured with superimposed black bands, standing next to a bleary-eyed and shackled Manuel Noriega in the back of a cargo aircraft. A gold automatic pistol taken from one of Saddam's palaces was mounted in a case near the end of the hallway, and a row of photos of more men and even a few women, their eyes again blacked out, standing around men with bagged heads and shackles. The hallway displayed the secret history of this organization. A force of outlaw hunters that reached back 150 years, and although neither of the two men hurrying up the corridor were thinking of it now, they fully expected to commission a new memorial very soon to commemorate the successful resolution of their current hunt. At the end of the hall was a well-lit alcove, and here another man with a military haircut stood at parade rest next to a small desk. An HK submachine gun hung from a sling over his shoulder, and to his right, a heavy steel door was flush with the wall. A small sign on the door read, "Signal Room, Biometric Access Only." The guard at the door said, "Evening, Mr. Babbitt. Sweet tux." Lee Babbitt placed his hand on a small screen on the wall next to the door. As he waited there for the biometric finger reader to confirm his identity, he acknowledged the man.